Matthew, Mr. Kent.
Hi, it's great to be here with everyone.
I know you've been here with us before. I want to set this up just a little bit by way of, because if we're going to talk about, you know, fruit of contemplative practice or anything like that, maybe a little context might be helpful. If you get the blurb, the weekly blurb that I write and send out about where we're kind of headed for the talky bit, this part of our gathering, if you got the first one, before all the where are we going updates, you may have noticed that the subject line had something to do with the subversive, radical and subversive nature of contentment. And so that's what we're going to talk about this morning, Matthew and I, is about that idea and about the way that it kind of connects to contemplative practice and bringing those practices into our lives. But I wanted to provide just a little bit of context for that idea because, and we'll define our terms a little more as we go, but the idea of contentment can feel kind of slippery to, I think, us in our age and our time. Not something that we're necessarily told might be good really often. In fact, more often than not, the working assumption of our culture is that discontentment is the norm, that anxiety is the norm, or fear, or apprehension. And in any case, if we are people who are not content or not practicing things in our lives that foster contentment, we're uniquely vulnerable to being told what we need. There's nobody that's easier to market to than somebody that can easily be made to feel discontent. Because in that state of mind, in that state of life, we're uniquely vulnerable to being told what we should have in order to feel the way that we want to feel, the way that we're made to be. So contentment, that's sort of a short commercial version of a way that contentment can subvert things in our culture that are, you know, not good for us. This is not a new set of ideas, of course, and contemplative practices are not a new thing. So when I was thinking about this and thinking, like, how do you kind of open this by way of maybe an historic figure, somebody who might kind of feel like their story is resonant with some of these themes. The person that came quickly to my mind was...
I always just go with Jesus, but
yeah,
go ahead.
The answer to everything, yeah, that's right. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head, but he seems to be okay and all that, yeah, so we're good. This is not Jesus. This guy kind of liked Jesus, though, so we're kind of, you know, anyway, Francis of Assisi, not to make it too long-winded. So some of you would be aware of Francis as a saint, depending on where you grew up and how, you know, many of those stories you're... Like, late 1100s or so, this guy kind of is born. He grows up as a privileged child of merchants, Italian merchants, cloth merchants. So he's a wealthy child of privilege. He has everything. And he's in business, kind of from go, and he has all his business, young other rich business buddies, and they're selling fabric on the weekdays, and they're partying hard on the weekend. And then something happens for Francis, and he begins to feel as though there's something fundamentally wrong with this. That the places for, and for him, this place is the church, because he's Catholic as well. And I mean, every Christian was this sort of point in history. But for him, the fact that the neighborhood physical church was falling down felt like there was a message there for him, a spiritual message that basically said something good is in decay and needs to be rebuilt. And so he famously walks away from the life of privilege and wealth that he has. And whether this is, you know, kind of hagiography or whether this is literal history doesn't matter. It's a great story because the story is so easy to visualize. This may be an uncomfortable visualization, you decide, but he takes off all his clothes in the center of town, all his wealthy garments, his rich fabrics, puts them in a pile in the middle of the town square and kind of walks out of town and into this life of voluntary simplicity, which continues to mark the Franciscan order, the order that he saw, that he founded. One of several, but probably the most visible one. He becomes a person that history now kind of looks back on and says, here's someone who not only chose a life of voluntary simplicity and poverty, but someone for whom that produced such a beautiful story shape to what we might use a short word like gospel for, or good news for, that included things like, I mean, this is the patron saint of the animals. This is the guy who, you know, would sit in the meadow and be quite happily occupied with just him and the world around him. Someone who had a deep sense of connection to the earth and the things of the earth, and of people on the margins of the stories, all those kind of things. I wanted to just read, and we'll get on with our conversation, but I wanted to read a couple of lines from a poem that's talking about the life of Francis that kind of brings together this idea that we could make practical embodied choices in our lives that actually change the way things happen in our spirit, and that's kind of part of a cycle out of which comes things, different things that happen in our lives. So it kind of goes around, right? So this is from a Malcolm Guite poem from a section of a book called The Singing Bowl, in which he writes a whole bunch of different poems about different saints. So this one is about Francis. I won't read you the whole thing, but just this bit. Undoing set you free, loosened the traps of trappings, cast away the trammeling of all that costly cloth we wind our Savior in. And I just thought, yeah, that's a great description, among other things, of religion, all these costly things that we wind the goodness of God in so often. And that setting even things like that aside, setting aside the trappings that trammel the beauty of the divine and freeing us to engage. What a lovely thought. So we want to talk about contentment. So let's, one of the reasons Matthew and I are having this conversation, let me rephrase that. One of the reasons that I'm having this conversation with you in particular, Matthew, is because you're a person that I know for whom contemplative practice has become something more than an add-on. It's become a central feature of your way of life and your way of being and engaging in the world. And I described you to somebody recently as, you know, my favorite sort of 21st century contemplative that I know. And so that deep practice, that deep alteration of life around contemplative practice and beginning to see the fruit of that practice, that makes me really excited to have this conversation with you, because these are not ideas for you. These are ways of life. But let's start with a couple of defining a couple of terms, because contentment in particular sort of feels like it could be a slippery idea, could mean many different things. When we're talking about contentment this morning, what are we talking about?
Well, first of all, thank you. That's pretty sweet. And also, I appreciate you setting the context so that I don't have to do that. Because when I speak about these things, I'm not so much interested in sharing any particular ideas that I've discovered, because the ideas that I've discovered haven't really been the things that have changed my life most profoundly. And they've been a part of the story, but it's sort of what these words and, you know, the poetry and the stories, they point to something that we can experience for ourselves. And I think when I think about contentment, I think about this sense of being deeply at ease with life, with yourself. I won't ask for a show of hands, so you can just kind of keep this on the DL. But I would ask the question, who here feels deeply content and at ease in their life, in general? You know, that you would say that is the defining feature, or a defining feature of your experience. Okay? So, for anyone who feels like, yes, that is true, you don't really have to pay much attention to anything that's going to happen here. Your job, you just get to be exactly as you are and just exude that ease of being. Because one of the reasons why I feel so and find a growing sense of passion and interest in being able to speak about and offer some kind of guidance or facilitation in these things is it's just so rare to actually see people who are deeply content and at ease with life, you know, in the midst of all of the challenges and difficulties and pain that is a part of our experience so much of the time. And I think one of the biggest gifts that any of us can offer is actually being content and just being able to be that way in the world around us. And however that manifests itself and however that's expressed, that is secondary. But there's thinking about Francis, like when I think about defining contentment, you know, it's a word that points us towards something. And I think most of us, even if that's not our primary experience and not how we feel that we are in the world, most of us, if not all of us, have had moments and glimpses of that, of experiencing that in some kind of direct, tangible way. Even if it's just encountering another person who expresses it deeply in their being. You know, someone who would have known Francis at the time, someone who saw what he was doing or who spoke with him, that there's something transmitted in our presence to say, like, oh, there's something there that's different, that kind of deep anxiety that we are conditioned to see as normal and just part of our natural way of being, that doesn't actually have to be there. And I think that, when I think about good news, that's pretty top of the list. Just that kind of radical possibility. And I think it is radical just in the fact that, a couple of reasons. One, you know, we think of radical in the one sense as just like so far out there, so different from what we're used to. But also in this deeper sense of radical as the root of something. And that's kind of the primary thing that I continue to come back to, is this deep sense of contentment that is discovered for some through contemplative practice or all kinds of different ways, is actually a fundamental part of life and reality that we just often don't see or don't recognize most of the time.
I don't find it that difficult to imagine that if we hadn't encountered an idea like this or a possibility like this in our lives, the idea that contentment could be a radical way of subverting things around us that are not good, mm-hmm. not lovely. I mean, we've commercialized dis-ease as a culture. Like we've pathologized not being content, and we know that that's not great. That's why we call it a disease, right? That's why we fill manuals with the definitions of it, and we spend bazillions of dollars trying to make it shut up and go away. So we know this is not what we're meant to be. And yet, when we encounter someone whose deep core reality is contentment, sometimes they just make us nervous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why is that? Like, why wouldn't our first response more likely be one of resonance of, oh, that's the thing. That's what I'm hungry for.
Yeah. That's a great question. I don't know that I have a definitive answer, but even if I look at my own experience and, you know, the trajectory of my path, I can see a reluctance to actually be okay. And I think of what you were sharing, the que sera, sera. It's like, well, if I'm really that okay, I'm kind of not in control of what's happening. And, you know, if we stop and think for a minute, we're not really in control of much of anything most of the time, maybe ever at all. But there's something about letting go of that desire that I think can feel very overwhelming, because it's like, well, if I really am that deeply okay, who's going to protect me? What's going to protect me?
Is part of this that we have almost zero training about imagining how life where we're not in control might actually be good?
Yeah, And probably, you know, we don't see that many examples, I think, oftentimes as well. So that for sure limits our imagination if we don't, if we can't actually see some greater possibility lived out in this way. It's kind of like, ooh, I don't know if I really want to, go there.
What do you think we're afraid will happen?
That's a great question for everyone to consider. Yeah, I don't.
Nice.
I don't. It's. I mean, because the answer, whatever answer I give, is kind of irrelevant. It's
yes.
More this sense of, well, not irrelevant, but
it's not global.
It's, and even if it is, some of these kind of questions, there's no. So part of, I think, what this undermines in general, is. This sense we have that in order to be content, it means that all of our problems have to be solved. And it means that all of the things that bother and disturb us have to go away somehow. And that's somehow the goal behind all of this. And we have this idea of, yes, I want to be okay, I want to be at ease, I want to be content. But I can only do that when my experience is kind of squished into this very narrow strip of these are the things that I want to happen, and this is what I want my life to be like. And anything outside of that is not good, and I can't be okay with that. And so we have this this relationship with contentment that's always kind of keeps it out of arm's reach, because maybe it's just me, but I suspect other people share my experience that there's always going to be something in life that is not the way you want it to be in some way or another, that there's some kind of yeah, things just don't go the way that you expect them to. Or what you want to see in your relationships with other people is not what you would desire. There's an endless list of reasons to not be okay. And when I say be okay, I don't mean having some particular kind of emotional experience that feels really good. Because that's pretty easy to want. You know, we want to feel good. That's a natural thing. But I think when I really look more deeply, when I really look more deeply into what contentment draws me towards and points me to, it's this wide embrace of life, of the full range of experience that includes the stuff that's really not comfortable. And we kind of want to push those things aside, but that's actually, it does the opposite. You know, we feel like we need to push these things aside in order to be okay and feel okay and be content. But that doesn't actually help, because then all of a sudden we have this anxiety and concern about trying to keep everything away. And it's like, well, what happens? What happens if we just stop trying to push these things away? If we stop trying to push the sometimes harsh realities of our experience away from actually being able to be with those things?
I'm glad you said what you just said about all of that, Matthew, because to me, otherwise, some of what you're describing, and you and I have talked about this a little bit in our own conversations, can sound suspiciously like apathy. or indifference, or just kind of like, or you know, kind of a, you know, Martha Stewart or whomever philosophy, but it's like, or whomever, it's like, it's all good, you know? Yeah. I could just name the wrong celebrity.
I'm sure she would say that too.
It's not the first time. But it's all good. Yeah. So, that experience of you know, it kind of none of it matters. Mm. So what you're describing is living in a world in which those things matter to us and impact us, but the way that we respond to them is different than the way we would respond if we were trying to control them all.
Yes.
Is that, I'm hearing that correctly?
Yeah.
So, I mean, thinkers about things like our human experience for a long time have, sometimes it feels like they're just fiddling around with the words, but we're actually trying to get at the thing underneath the thing. So what comes to mind is, in the moment, is, for instance, is C.S. Lewis talking about the difference between happiness and joy. And saying that for him, happiness, you could get happiness, like, again, this is Lewis's take on it, but kind of like a bottle of really great booze and a woman, and I might feel happy, but that's not the same thing as joy. So those kind of distinctions, right? That there's a way we can make ourselves feel something. We can kind of have this affective experience of like, woohoo, this feels great. But that's not the same thing as the thing we were after. When you think about engaging fully in the world from a place of the ease, is the word you've used, about being able to receive the full range of human experience, and rather than being anxious, being able to still be content, can you kind of just imagine, can you just help us imagine what a life like that looks like? I mean, I think it's foreign enough that a little illustration might not be, you know,
well, I think, again, we already had such a great illustration this morning with your story where you were describing this, and I loved everything about how you described it, because it was like you were talking about this change of perspective and orientation somehow that as you described it seemed like you didn't really have control over and you didn't like make happen in some kind of way. And also what I thought was great about it is feeling this whole que sera sera, you didn't just decide to like, oh, I'm just not going to do anything. I'm just going to stay at home. I'm not going to show up to this. I'm not going to speak. That wasn't a concern of like, well, I guess I'm just not going to do anything.
Sort of the switch from active to passive, or kind of going into victim mode as part of that. Everything, it's okay if everything in life just happens to me.
Right.
Right, which is different than being an actor in this from a place of contentment. Is that sort of what you're describing?
Yeah, describing a sense of, again, what I think was so beautiful about the story is when we become aware of this deep abiding contentment and ease, that's not, one, it's not something we generate and create for ourselves by, I'm just going to focus on really positive things, and that it becomes some kind of mental practice or activity.
So it's not willful self-deception.
It's definitely not willful self-deception. And as that seems like a good in for the contemplative practice dimension of it, in that we're not practicing, or the way I understand it anyway, is we're not practicing kind of making ourselves really content or making ourselves really at ease or anything forceful. Like, I just need to practice being content really hard, and then I'll be able to be content when life is tough. The way that I view meditation or any kind of contemplative practice is it's valuable for a lot of reasons, but in this sense, it's kind of tilling the ground and creating the availability to actually receive that and become open to that, because it's not something we get to control or generate, but it's something that naturally arises in us when we begin to do that exercise internally of being able to open up and let go of this intense contraction holding on that we have. As this kind of arises in us, there's the discovery that we don't actually want to sit around and do nothing, you know. St. Francis didn't take his clothes off and then just have a nap and then just stay there for the rest of his life and be like, well,
I guess... Until his abusive father showed up and
beat
him.
Yeah, I guess this is good. I'll just hang out here. I mean, there certainly have been, saints and sages and mystics throughout time who have taken a very withdrawing path. And, hey, maybe that's appropriate. Maybe that's where you'll be led to go. I don't know. I don't see it too often, so I don't think that's something we need to be overly concerned with, but we encounter a different kind of motive for being in the world. And so this summer I was at a retreat, and it was in North Carolina, and I was driving from here, so it was a very long trip, and during the first leg I had a really interesting kind of spiritual experience, and I won't get into the gist of it, but what emerged from that as I was writing and reflecting at the end of the day was this deep sense that I really didn't need to worry about anything, like really didn't need to do that, totally not necessary, and that I didn't have to worry about fixing myself, I didn't have to worry about fixing my life, I didn't have to worry about fixing anyone else, that was okay. And I had this thought afterwards where I just realized, oh my gosh, if I'm not worried about anything, what am I going to spend my time thinking about? Like, seriously, I thought about it. I was like, my gosh, like 90% of what's going on in my mind is some variation of worry and concern. I was like, whoa, I have so much free time. What are you going to do with that? And it's like, it's shocking if you when you begin to look at that, like how much of our attention is occupied by things we have no control over. And what emerged from that kind of space in that moment wasn't the sense of like, oh, I don't really care about anything. It was like, oh my gosh, there's so much more room to actually care about stuff that matters. And how much of our time and attention is given to things that in our best and highest and clearest moments, we would say, like, that's really not important at all. And so this idea that contentment is somehow dangerous or irresponsible or whatever it happens to be, you know, that response only comes from this part of ourselves that really doesn't want the way things are to be undermined, because there's a certain kind of comfort with feeling like, yeah, okay, it's maybe not great, but it feels kind of secure and kind of predictable, and that's kind of what I like.
Is part of that just about the sort of the devil you know and the devil you don't, in the sense of sometimes I think we like this idea of control because we feel familiar with it. The idea of receiving life and the possibility of being at ease or content, even in the midst of turmoil or troubling things or challenging things, feels so foreign to us that it's actually can actually be experienced as an offense.
Yeah.
So I have an acquaintance who's, by personality, among other things, less inclined to worry than their spouse, not an unusual story, but who in one conversation with them said something along the lines of, this is a paraphrase, something along the lines of, you know, dear, you know how you can tell when something bad's not going to happen? Basically because you're worrying about it. Like, what percentage of bad things you worry about actually happen? And, you know, so, like, she has to kind of confess it's a very small percentage. So he's like, there you go. Like, you know how to tell if something bad's not going to happen. You're worried about it. There's 90% odds. And she was not very happy. It wasn't a productive conversation. Don't do that. But it does illustrate how naturally we kind of go there, right? How kind of just that's our way of operating. And when we're presented with the possibility that there might be a way to live that honestly receives life with its vicissitudes, but doesn't feel like that means we need to turn them into trying to wrestle them into a particular shape, but rather to receive them. And from that place of relative contentment and ease, we act in the world. Mm. So the idea of a contented activist feels weird.
Yeah.
To us, right? Isn't an activist somebody who's like categorically pissed off about something and really riled up? You know?
So, and there's reasons to be really riled up.
And there are things to
off.
Act about,
yeah.
absolutely, that need to be different than they are.
Yeah.
But where we act from mm-hmm. can vary enormously, right? And that's sort of what we're yeah. talking about.
Yeah, and I think we're inundated with the message where it's like, well, you either don't really care, or the opposite is you have to be motivated by outrage and anger and absolute discontentment with the way things are, because that's the only motive we have for, or even within a spiritual context, it's often the case of, you know, we should be motivated, we need to kind of see ourselves as not okay in order to be motivated to become better. Mm-hmm. And we have to see the world as not good in order to be motivated to try and make a difference. And it's not that there isn't some effectiveness and power to that, because there is. But I think probably for most of us, you know, that's not really necessary anymore. And that's maybe reached its limit of usefulness.
Well, that's a sort of a contemplative view in on something like shame as well,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
It's in the end, it doesn't really work.
Yeah.
But in the near term, we might use it as a lever.
Right,
and we get
yeah.
the short-term return.
Yes.
The kind of the wise one story that comes to mind out of the life of Jesus is sort of talking about the different ways people pray and saying the people who pray so that they'll be recognized, get recognition, and then that the loop's closed, right? You got everything you came for from
yeah.
that perspective. And so when we come with a lever like shame and try to get a certain result in a relationship and we get that result, we just got everything we came for.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get the thing that motivated us in the first place, which
yeah.
might have been intimacy or honesty or you know, whatever it is, like a good thing, right?
Yeah.
And that stuff can all shift when the perspective from which we act. We may still need to have a hard conversation with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
We may still need to join the march. We might still need to write the letter.
Yeah.
You know, whatever our action in the world toward a better world looks like, but where we're doing it from can be radically different.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a reasonable
yeah.
way to restate what I've heard you saying?
That's a great way of restating it.
Awesome.
And I think from one, just to fill out the orientation that I see myself and I understand this from, is the more deeply rooted I am in this acceptance of what my experience is, what reality seems to be at any moment, the more available I become for spirit to do something through me, where there's less kind of baggage or blockage in the way, that we actually become more available to be able to shape the world in profoundly good and positive ways that we can't really even imagine with coming from this place of fear or shame or guilt or those kind of motives that consume so much of our attention. And that's, so it's not even, there's so much personal benefit that I experience, but more and more I'm convinced it's not really about that. It actually is deeply about being able to engage and participate in life in a way that brings so much more goodness and beauty and truth into the world.
When we gather at the table, we gather in a sort of recognizable shape. That, you know, we might use a word like church for this. We might not, but it wouldn't be a weird word to use for it, given the context. And so I, as a person involved in that kind of a gathering, I'm listening to you talk about this stuff, Matthew, and I can't help but think about what you said and what Geit said, gestured toward in the poem, that in so many ways we often do the same thing with our spiritual practices. I'm going to use the word religion in this context, mm-hmm. that we do with the rest of life. We wrap it up in all kinds of things that are really mostly there to give us the illusion that this is something we're in control of. And it's only good when it behaves the way we think it should. Cohen, the song we sang last week, The God of small things is, what's that, what's actually the couplet? God of small things is always calling. The God of small things has so many rules. Is that right? Okay. So that idea, when I know when I first heard that verse in that song, I just thought, oh my word, like you just described most of our religious experiences most of the time. The God of small things is always calling, like always demanding something, always measure up, always do this, always do that. There's so many rules. What does it look like if we could just let go of some of those insistences that this has to be my way or it's not going to be in that little thin slice of my life that's good? It just seems to me that the obvious answer to the question, what's going to happen, is I'm going to actually become open to the possibility of the divine. Because my definition of that is guaranteed to fall short. My experience of it, if I'm trying to manage it, is guaranteed to be partial. And I'm going to walk away with that same feeling that I'm having about the rest of life, which is like I need to wrestle this under control or it's not good. But when I wrestle it under control and I get what I came for, it's not good. Shit. That's a lousy loop to live in, right? So the alternative possibility is a liberating one to imagine. But it does take some practice.
Yeah, I think to me it feels like, you know, for all of us, there's an ongoing, unending, freely offered invitation to open ourselves to the divine in every moment that we encounter. And that is a possibility that the more I allow myself to recognize that and be shaped by that, only good things happen.
By which you do not necessarily mean only the things I want to have happen.
That is correct. With a little asterisk and addendum on there.
Yeah.
Good in quotation marks.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of places we could go. I think let's leave it there for today, for this conversation. May I invite people to look you up after and just chat away?
Yeah.
You're good with that?
Yeah.
Don't have to rush off and wrestle the world back under control just right away?
No, I do not.
Okay, awesome. I was not being cynical. Can we just express our thanks to Matthew for coming and joining us this morning? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.